Good evening and welcome to a Fireside Chat. This is your host, Lance White, also known as Zany Mystic. Tonight's guest is John Hoag, who's best known for his expertise in Nostradamus, Earth and social changes, political and astrological predictions. He's authored numerous books on prophecy and is a guest on national radio, cyber radio, and TV shows. And he's probably considered one of the top leading experts at this point on Nostradamus prophecies. So, let's see if John can help us peer into the near future by welcoming Tim to the show. Hello, John. How are you?
It's great to be on your show, Lance.
Oh, good, good, good. Let's go to the back a few years, and we don't have to go all the way into babyhood, but how about to a time when you first discovered your interest in Nostradamus?
Well, it all began with a fascination with history. I had, from early age, a fascination with history and current events because they seemed to be, current events were the twinkle in history's eye that becomes, since we're going back to babyhood metaphors, and that twinkle or a tilt becomes our historical record. And I was fascinated with the way history, I kind of look at it as a pathology, because most of history, at least how the kind of history that's delivered to us is mostly the negative, politically based, you know, the annals of the heroically insane rather than people who sing and dance and, you know, we don't go to high school to learn the history of how jokes were created or the day that people discovered that sitting on the beach was really a wonderful place.
It's true.
We talk about idiots like Hitler and Stalin and Jim Jones and the crusading popes and the people who burned down Alexandria Library. So the thing is, I started looking at it kind of as if it was a disease that perhaps could be cured. And so I, after a while, after just voraciously studying all I could on history, I started getting involved with the study of future history because of my parallel interest in the path of awareness and meditation, the seeking of enlightenment of any form or kind while being in this gift of a body in this planet, and the planet we all hail as home. And that I saw in the future scriptures the study of future history, which had a lot of the same repetitive mistakes and stupidities and hopes and fears that were struggled with in the past. And so it seemed that then the study started to get into, well, what is the engine that makes us so predictable that we have a future to predict? It's an important question because not only in studying Nostradamus, which I'm most known for, I've written several books also that include Nostradamus and hundreds of other seers from all different times looking, seeing if they all share a lot of collective hopes and fears about the future, no matter where they are in the world and what period of history. And they do, actually. And one of the things that is common in them is a sort of a cutoff in the noise of prophecies that go silent suddenly in the first half of this century. And then there's not a whole lot of prophecies about the distant future. And yet, people were making predictions for the last several thousand years of known civilization and quite a thick and constant flow. So, you know, I wondered, well, what does that mean? Are we reaching a singularity of where the critical mass of our repetitive, happenstance-related, conditioned reflex, Pavlovian history, puts us into a self-destruct and there is no tomorrow for the human race? Or, because of that same danger, which is seen by all prophetic traditions, perhaps the human race in the flaming house that was once their home, planet Earth, starts putting out the fire. And in putting out the fire, have to look at who set the fire. The homo pyromaniac humanity. And then create a new humanity. Because there are many There are many prophecies, mostly written by the prophets that I champion, and that is those rebels who had a track record of accurate predictions, but were kind of rendered to the sidelines by mainstream religions because their view of the future did not fit with the politically correct end game that most religions expect. And these I champion more than anything else and put them in the forefront so we can hear them.
Good. We like rebels.
Yes, because it's rebelliousness is another form of mutation. Mutation is evolution. That monkey who rebelled against living in the trees, who landed on the ground and couldn't get back into the trees, became a hominid.
Yeah.
So we are in a century that's probably as significant in falling out of our tree of complacency than when we became hominids. In fact, you might say, as the mystic Osho has said in the East, that the human race has not needed to grow up until now.
Yeah.
So we will grow up because we're not going to die. Survival, the sense of the survival of the race is too strong.
Huh.
But it's going to be a bumpy ride.
I take it Osho is one of the prophets that you referred to there, the ones that you...
One of the rebel prophets, yeah.
Yeah. Who are some of the other ones?
Well, Osho, Krishnamurti.
Oh, yeah.
Roger Bacon from the 12th century or so. Joaquin de Fiore, who was a man who I use in the end of my book, The Last Pope Revisited, which is an e-book that's for sale on my website, hopeprophecy.com. He talked about a fascinating idea of the process of God's evolution of man on earth is in three ages. And this is a man who was around the 1200s who said this in Calabria in southern Italy. And he said that the three ages were roughly 2,000 years in length, and they corresponded with the Holy Trinity. So the first age was the age of the Father, which is the very Old Testament jealous Godfather, you know, of the world. And then the next one was the era of the Son, which is Jesus, or Yeshua, as he was actually called. Jesus is a Greco-Roman misnomer that was added. And the third age is the age we're about to enter, and that's the age of the Holy Spirit. And this Calabrian monk basically felt that in that age we would not need a middle man. God would not have us have to go through a priesthood or hierarchy, but to be directly created with the Holy Spirit and communing with it, which is an interesting point of view because there are a number of other non-Christian or non-Judeo-Christian or Islamic visionaries in the East that have similar view in what is called, you know, there are many Vedic prophets that talk about, well, to give you an idea, there are 10 avatars or world teachers that are supposed to come in a cycle of four ages called the Yugas. And we are, there's a lot of politics of mathematics in Hindu mythology and that it seems like the bigger the number, the more important. But if one kind of settles down and distills it down to realities of how much real time we've really been in civilization here, you're looking at every avatar coming every 25 centuries, what the Buddhists call the Wheel of Dharma.
Okay.
It rolls every 25 centuries, you get a Buddha, and then now it's 25 centuries later, it's supposed to be another world teacher, world religious renovation movement.
Huh.
Now, the Hindus believe that this person will be called Kalki, and he'll ride a white horse and slice down the wicked with his sword. And doesn't that sound a little bit like Revelation 13?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Glorious and true on the white horse, riding with the sword, the tongue that's a sword that slaughters the nations.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because the Vedic version of that predates the Judeo-Christian version of that by thousands of years.
Huh.
So it may be that our apocalyptic thinking is exported from the East.
Quite possibly, yeah.
So with this kind of bouncing around as I've done here, it's going to give your listeners, because some of them probably it's the first time they've ever heard me, a kind of an idea of the wide-ranging focus of my interests and rather rebellious focus of my rogue scholarly interest in prophecy.
Yes, I like that a lot. That tickled my fancy quite a bit when I read that. Just out of curiosity, before you go on, I wanted to ask where the divine feminine energies or the Holy Mother might fit into the triad that you were mentioning earlier.
Well, usually it's the explanation is it's in the Holy Spirit.
Okay.
So that is that interesting to me in particular because of a 36-year cycle that we're ending that actually marks a grand cycle of what's called a cosmic month, which is 2,000 normal years. We're entering ending a month that lasted the age of Pisces since Jesus was around,
uh-huh.
And now we're entering the age of Aquarius. And even though the age of Aquarius is on face value a yang masculine sign,
uh-huh.
All signs are always expressed in their opposite. For instance, the Piscean age, being a feminine sign, was actually expressed through a masculine way.
Right.
And the same thing is going to happen here with the Aquarian. It's going to reverse to a feminine way. So you're going to see what that means in layman's terms is, starting around 2008, starting actually now for 2008,
okay.
Which, by the way, is far more significant time than 2012.
Really?
We'll get into that a little later.
Yes, that's important. Let's not forget that.
That you're going to start seeing a shift towards the feminine, towards the goddess, towards these. It'll be very subtle at first,
uh-huh.
and the initial shift is going to take at least 36 years before it really gets rooted, before it's reaped and sows something anew for the next 36-year period in 2044, starting with 2044. And that's why it's not at all surprising to me, and I've been saying it since 1998 when I was on The View in ABC, that it's not at all surprising to me if we'd have a woman as a president in 2008. And I made the prediction it would be Hillary Clinton, which they thought was pretty funny at that time because she was still trying to become a senator of New York.
And
I said, no, you've heard it here. It's going to happen. And I kind of do a lot of presidential predictions. I've done the popular vote predictions since 1968, and I'm 10-0.
Well, so one thing about Hillary Clinton that I've heard that gives her a distinct advantage is that she's supported by the Bilderbergs.
Yes. Who are they?
Well, it's a group that basically some of the wealthiest people, you know, the people who own, you know, everything, and she's definitely a participant with the Bilderberg group. So
yeah, she's going to be has the potential, if she's elected, she has the potential to be Nixon in skirts. There's this very before I go the way of Don Imus, let me explain what I mean by that. We are undergoing a lot of prophecies about cycles.
Yeah.
And we are a nation, just like an individual. It's like a family of a nation. Sometimes goes through a karmic lesson as a whole nation.
Yeah.
And if they learn the lesson, they you'll know because it comes back 20 years or 40 years later for a review.
Right.
Now, I'll give you an example. Germany, in 1914, went to war and kind of listened to that battle fever that's so latently deep down inside the German culture.
Yeah.
And they ended up being defeated in 1918, signing the Versailles Treaty. And rather than being pacified by being defeated, they actually got angrier, found another leader, and then 20 years later, they go again into World War II, and this time really get whacked.
Yep.
And then, of course, you wonder, okay, have they learned the lesson, or in 45 are we going to see something in 75 or four Dutchers, yeah, I can't count, 65, that would indicate that they are going to go to war again, and the steel helmet would come rising again and threaten Europe. Well, it didn't. In fact, the Germans had become peaceful, democratic, and so they had learned as a group their lesson. Now, interestingly enough, in the 60s, we were going through a major set of karmic lessons as a country with Vietnam, with civil rights, with all kinds of things, and Nixon, Watergate, all of this. We are echoing that, almost like a reverse image of the same thing, or to use a musical metaphor, it's like taking a theme and turning it upside down, like... Victor Borga used to do, remember he used to get on the piano and he'd go, and stop, look at the music again, turn it over and go,
great.
So we actually have that going on now because back 40 years ago, we had a Texan president who got himself into a war in Vietnam with rather spurious reasons, the Gulf of Tonkin. Yeah. And got himself in a quagmire, which divided his own party, which kind of melted down and allowed, for the first time in a long time, a Republican, Richard Nixon, to win in 1968. Go fast forward 40 years, you have a Texan Republican president going to war with spurious reasons in Iraq in a quagmire. His party melting down, and it's leading to a Nixonian Democrat who will probably win the election. What I hope about that Nixonian Democrat is that since she started her political career fighting Nixon, I hope she's learned the lessons of Nixon and will do the thing that Nixon nearly did, and that is there were times when Nixon approached greatness.
Yes.
But he was undermined by the darker nature, angels of his nature, his paranoia.
Yes.
And I see a similar problem with Clinton. And if she, hopefully, because she's got a heck of a lot better political advisor than Nixon did.
Yeah.
Nixon pretty much was on his own with that. I hope that she will not fall into the same temptations that Nixon did. Otherwise, she might have the new Gerald Ford, who is also the black Kennedy, who's echoing the white Kennedy, JFK, Barack Obama, her vice presidential choice, will become president.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting, and we know what happened to Kennedy.
Well, that's another cycle.
Yeah.
That's another cycle to talk about. That's the cycle of the curse of Tecumseh. Or what is known in astrology as the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction, which happens every 20 years, which means it's every time we elect a president in a political campaign in a year that ends in a zero, every 20 years, that president, since 1840, when the curse was unleashed by Tecumseh the Shaman, who said that you will lose a great white chief every generation, which is 20 years, for what they did in a war against him. And he meant that to the man who defeated him, Harrison, who then became president and went out to speak before everyone at the inauguration day in a long speech in the driving rain with a bare head, caught pneumonia, and died a month later. And 20 years later, Abe Lincoln, 1860, is elected, survives his first term, but is assassinated early in his second term. 20 years later, you have Garfield assassinated. 20 years later, you have McKinley in 1900 assassinated. 20 years later, you have Harding die in scandal and die of some disease in office. 20 years later, you have 1940, and you have Franklin Delano Roosevelt considering the unprecedented third term. He is elected in an unprecedented third term, but dies shortly after in his fourth term. You know, April, he had been elected a fourth time in 44 and then died in early 1945. So you go 20 years later after that, you have John F. Kennedy, who was assassinated. And then you go 20 years after that, and you have Ronald Reagan in 1980, elected president. And in 81, he is shot, but he survived.
Yeah.
Now, some people think, does that mean that Reagan had broken the curse? I mean, we know that Ronald Reagan privately through his wife, was very interested in astrology.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, Richard Nixon used to use Gene Dixon as a consultant secretly.
Oh, really?
As did Roosevelt.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's not well known, of course, politically speaking. One wouldn't want to have a witch doctor come in and talk to you, but
right. You
would be surprised, maybe not so surprised, how many people in power circles use astrologers and mystics as kind of another angle on the same old problem.
Yeah.
So what you had here is a question amongst the prophecy watchers is, did the curse finally be broken by Reagan? Of course, in astrology, you notice that every other time the conjunction has happened, it's happened in an earth or fire sign, which in layman's terms is it's heavy duty. But this one in 80 happened in an air sign, which means it was the softest impact. Now, the softest impact was that Reagan survived by an inch of his life in this assassination attempt. He almost died on the operating table.
Well, they say he was never the same after that.
And that is also the case.
Yeah.
So now we come to 2000, and we have a president who clearly won the popular vote by over 500,000 people, a disputed election in Florida, and what some people view as an illegitimate winner through electoral college. And so what you then have is perhaps a political assassination of the rightful winner of the 2000 election.
Oh, yeah.
Now that may be so, but we still have to see, because George W. Bush is the president, and he is in his second term. No president who has survived this conjunction through the first term has survived the second.
Oh.
So it'll be, I mean, hopefully he'll break that curse. You know, no matter what people think about, good or ill, about the president, it wouldn't be a national tragedy.
Right.
And so, but this is what we have to yet see. It also could mean he might be the first president who is thrown out of office in history, which would be nearly as catastrophic as losing your office.
I can't see him ever giving up that office.
Well, that is an interesting point, because if you're talking to a higher father and not the Constitution, that is a possibility. And
I mean, I can just see the election having been won by somebody else, and them having to literally peel him off the wall to get him out of the office.
Yeah, the thing is, back in that same show on The View in 1998, I basically said whoever the next president was, he would have, I didn't see an assassination, I saw an unexpected health crisis or a plane accident.
Mm.
So, you know, whether the plane accident was not an accident, I don't know. You know, I'm just simply reporting that's what I saw through the use of my own oracular disciplines.
Yeah.
And if I've read my signs right, hopefully I haven't, we'll see one of those things happen. But hopefully that'll be wrong.
Well, now you mentioned earlier that we're in the beginning of the major changes or the major shifts, and in 2007, 2008, and I know a lot of people that I talk to mention the coming pole shift, as well as the possible ascension or a singularity in which people are lifted from this dimension into another one.
Yes.
So where are we at now in terms of the 2012 Mayan prophecy in time?
Well, the I consider it the last of the Chicken Little prophecies. We had a whole flurry of them ramping up to the year 2000.
Yeah.
And then when that didn't happen, there was May 5th, 2000, a remarkably imaginative book written about 25 years before called 5-5-2000 by Richard Noon. A marvelous piece of imagination, completely wrong, but
yeah.
nothing happened on the 5th. So that's another one gone down.
Good.
The next biggie after that is 2012, which through the man under the pseudonym Jose Arguelles has done an amazing job of propagating its importance. It is important, by the way, but not as a doomsday date.
Okay.
Or not as a rapture date either. These dates are just some of a number of things in a time window of about 30 years that starting in the 90s and going through the next 20 years that are the end and beginning of many cycles. It's like I said in one of my books, the Millennium Book of Prophecy. You don't party till like it's 1999 on December 31st, 2000, and wake up with a hangover in the new age.
Yeah.
it's like this. I'd ask your listeners, when was the moment you stopped being a child and became a youth? When was the moment you were stopped being a young adult and became a middle-aged adult?
Yeah.
It's gradual.
Yeah.
Even if there's crises and spikes along the way.
Yeah.
And certainly in a time like this, we're going through a lot more intensity in a fast-paced time.
Yeah.
But the actual time of big changes is a little earlier. I get back to the idea that this very year and next year especially, you're going to see things that are going to be decided individually and collectively that will have momentum for at least the next 36 years and a grander extent the next 2000. And that is caused by what is called the great cosmic calendar, the cosmic year. And it's the largest of all of the Western calculations of ages. The cycle of centuries is what Nostradamus called it. And it is... This grand cycle is based on, if you're standing on the Earth looking at the vernal spring equinox, at the sunrise, it takes the sun somewhere around 25,700 years to pass through all 12 tropical constellations of the zodiac to return to its original place. So that's why, the Julian calendar had to be updated by the Gregorian, because otherwise we'd have spring in December, and there's this very slow, steady thing that happens. And so that can be broken down, as I said earlier, into months. There's 12 months of roughly, 2,150 years. And then you can distill those down to days. A day is a 24-hour period with day and night. That is, in normal years, in a cosmic day, a 72-year-long day that can be divided by a daylight period, the yang. That's where we husband and plant and seed future things.
Okay.
That's 36 years long. And then that is followed by a cosmic period of night, which is feminine, which is intuitive, receptive, harvesting. Giving birth to the things seeded, good or bad, for the next 36 years.
Oh.
So if we go back 36 years from now, we were in the year 1972-73.
Okay.
And you look at that and you'll see a number of important shifts in direction in history. We had the Munich terrorist event, and a few other things in 72, which clearly brought onto the stage the concept of Islamic terrorism. It began more as secular political, Palestinian and whatnot, but But this was the time that one started to equate terrorism from an Arab Middle Eastern source.
Okay.
It was also the time of the Yom Kippur War in 73, where there was also a shift in what happened, where the Arabs were starting to be able to fight back, and Sadat and the Egyptians were able to do that. And that actually led to kind of a wake-up call for both sides that led to peace between Egypt and Israel, which was the beginning of a roadmap to some kind of peace, which was still might as well be the road to Damascus with heat fevers of St. Paul. But anyway, so you have that. Then you also had Watergate.
Oh, yeah.
Which has completely, over the next 36 years, defined and overshadowed a U.S. citizen's view of their country and their government to where we're at this very sorry state right now. It all began 36 years ago.
Huh.
Now, there's also good things that happened, many good things. The early 70s was the beginning of this interesting shift of east to west and west to east. This is when you really began to see the West sharing its technological and rational know-how, and the East to begin to impress the West in its spiritual know-how,
mm-hmm.
its meditation. And that's when you saw the coming of people like Krishnamurti,
oh, yeah.
of Adida, of Raman Maharishi, at least in memory, Yogananda's ARE, even though he's already been, some of these had been there for decades. This is when the mainstream recognized them.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the time when Osho, who was then called Rajneesh, had his impact, where Westerners also started coming in their thousands to India to see Prabhupada's Hare Krishna, to see Osho and Maharishi and all that. The Beatles. All that is sort of the Beatles were a little earlier. They were trailblazers in that. The real flood of the change and communing of the two, of industry to the east, Eastern thought to the west, began then. That was also the time when ecological consciousness truly began.
Uh-huh.
You know, that was the years when the movie, the social commentary movie of Charlton Heston and called Soylent Green was created.
Oh, yeah.
Which was basically from the book Make Room, Make Room, which was an idea of a world in 2040 that had like 30 million people in New York City and, you know, a dozen billion people on the planet. And it was basically, its oceans were dying and people had to eat Soylent Green, this new soy product, which actually was people. There are interesting things about that have a certain prophetic echo to our times and what's coming.
Yeah.
So you see, these things started happening. So those were all planted in the yang of that. So 36 years, these harvests of bitter harvests, as well as sweet, have been planted. Now, at this time, 2007 through 2008, we are crossing over a margin in time where the decisions on how to harvest and be receptive to those good and bad things are going to be upon us and our leaders. And how we venture individually and collectively through the next 2 years is going to dictate how it's all harvested for the next 36 years.
Ah.
And then we begin another planting cycle of new directions of yang in 2044.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Interesting. I know that some people who do remote viewing and psychic explorations into the future seem to hit some kind of a wall around 2011. Is there any explanation for that one?
Well, it's interesting. They were hitting a wall at 2000.
That's
in 2001,
right.
10, 15 years ago.
That's true.
So what they're hitting is what I call prophetic bias. One thing that prophecy has taught me over the last 30 years of studying it since high school is that at the very least, it's a study in human projection.
Yeah.
It's a study in what we want to have happen or what we're afraid will happen.
Yeah.
And in those, in many ways, prophecy is also what I call a art of propaganda. In my book, Messiahs, I coined the two words, from propaganda to Armageddonomics. And that's where you convince, for instance, a lot of people have been convinced for 2,000 years that the Book of Revelations is talking about near future events.
Yeah.
You know, the Left Behind series has done a remarkable imaginative view of evangelical Christian Pentecostal ideas.
Oh, it's very creative.
Yeah, and yet John, St. John, if it's the actual apostle or some other person writing in Greek, I mean, the styles of the two are very different. In Patmos, who wrote the Book of Revelations, is not very subtle about how he wants you to get who the beast is. You know, the numerical equivalent, if you of his name, and you got to remember, and since it's in Greek, so it has to be in Greek, the scripture. They didn't have Arabic numbers then, so letters had numerical values. And so if you spell out something that will add up to 666, you will know the name of the man whose image is put on the coins and put on there, and you'll know who the beast is. Well, if you translate that, and he kept in the prophecy making it very clear it's now. It's not 2,000 years later. It's coming immediately. Christ is coming back right now. And it spells out Nero Kaiser in Greek, which means Nero Caesar.
Oh,
that was the emperor of Rome during the time that John of Patmos was writing, or near around that time. Also, it's known in the urban legends and myths of Rome and mysticism that they thought that Nero had had a head wound and that he had risen from the dead. That spurious urban legend of those days seems to have gotten into the prophecies of the Book of Revelation. And so, you know, it's pretty clear, push, nudge, nudge, we want it to be Nero. But there's another version of one of the oldest surviving versions of original text is another 100 years later. A copy of the Book of Revelations in Greek has the number 616. Now, 616 spells out the numerical equivalent of Caligula Kaiser. So, you know, why would Caligula be in there? Well, he is the emperor of Rome before Nero, who put a statue of Jupiter into the Holy Temple.
Yeah.
Defiling the Holy Temple. You can't do a more beastly thing to a devout Jewish mystic become Christian.
He supposedly did quite a lot of other beastly things too, didn't he?
Yes. Immortalized by John Hurt and I, Claudius.
Yeah, that was wonderful.
Great in drag, I must say. John Hurt is
really
great in drag. but yeah, stay away from the baby eating. That's really
bad. Yeah.
That's what Saturn does, not Jupiter, anyway. But this prophecy is one of the great, to get back on track here, is one of the great projections that has been propagated for 2,000 years. And what's very important to understand about prophecy is if you have for 2,000 years a propagation under 200 generations of people that this is about your future, you will self-fulfill this prophecy in some degree.
Yeah.
And if you're fool enough, you'll sit around looking around and go, gee whiz, boy, look how accurate these prophecies are about our time.
Yeah.
No,
yeah,
you're hypnotized.
Yeah.
You make them happen.
Exactly.
It's just like, to me, people like Pat Robertson are great evangelists of this stuff are like, on the one hand, reading the Bible, talking about the coming of this, and on the other hand, lighting the match, and one hand doesn't know what the other's doing.
Yeah, yeah.
But to be fair to Pat Robertson, Osama bin Laden and Muqtada al-Sadr of the Shias and bin Laden of the Sunnis both kind of, I think, believe that they are either the harbinger or the actual Mahdi, which is the Islamic apocalyptic version of this, that is going to march westward with the black flags and with armies in black outfits that will take back Jerusalem to the true religion of Islam and convert the world. Now, to be fair to them, if you look at all the other apocalyptic literature, everybody has the same modus operandi. It's either their spiritual city of capital of choice. For Judeo-Christian, Islamic, it's Jerusalem. You know, for the Tibetan apocalyptist, it's Shangri-La.
Yeah.
Or Vrindavan, if it's Hinduism. But they all have the idea that their religion will be tested, stay the narrow course, and when the apocalypse happens and the judgment happens and the big battle and all that, then we will come out of the ashes, we will rule the world, our Messiah will walk amongst us for 1,000 years. That's an Eastern messianism as well as Western.
Yeah.
Probably imported.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing that really gets me about this, and I did a rather controversial thing in the book Messiah, is I call it, I had a chapter called The 1,000-Year Reich of the Savior, where I talked about how Hitler, who was very much into prophecy, by the way, that you can see that he actually based his idea for Germania, his world 1,000-Year Reich capital, as the Jerusalem where all the subjected races would do obeisance to the Nazi rulers, and he stole that out of Daniel, and Zechariah, and the idea of a 1,000-year messianic empire. Understanding the word Messiah is, if you want to see somebody in the world today who is actually technically a Messiah, according to the linguistics of the word, the Dalai Lama is the closest thing you will find for his people, because a Messiah is a king, temporal king, and spiritual king of a nation.
Yeah.
And that is what the Messiah is supposed to be in Judeo-Christian concept. And he's supposed to live 1,000 years. And the thing that I saw very interesting in the scriptures is, if you kind of take a fresh look at the scriptures away from one's borrowed knowledge and conditioning, you'll notice that if you read these scriptures, it's kind of saying that if they don't dedicate themselves every year and to the new capital of the new Messiah, they will be punished with diseases and apocalypses and stuff like that. Plagues. And so I'm thinking, well, that's kind of like love me or else.
Really.
And
you're either with me or you're against me.
Yeah, and I started thinking about I had this little fantasy in that book where I talked about, you know, all the people coming out of the clouds all had the raccoon mascara and the blue hair and it forced us all in the tyranny of the Blessed One to sit in overstuffed Louis XIV chairs and Jesus Christ's religion becomes Jesus Kitsch. You know, and I thought, you know, I don't know if I want to sing praises to a 1,000 years of that, you know. And, of course,
it makes a funny story, and it would make a funny play too.
Well, you know, that's the thing. If you don't, in the prophecy business, if you don't gain a sense of humor, the prophecy business will eat you alive.
I can imagine,
because it's mostly bad news. So if you don't get some kind of cosmic gallows humor, you'll be in trouble.
Well, now, where does the Pope and the Catholic Church fit into all this? Because doesn't it play a significant role on the planet today?
Well, yes. In my ebook, The Last Pope Revisited, it's actually an electronic update of the book that I wrote back in 1998 about the prophecies of Saint Malachi.
Oh, yes.
And Malachi's prophecy is purported to have been set down in paper from a vision that the Irish saint had on a pilgrimage to Rome in, I think, 1140 A.D. And or CE, as they call it now. It didn't surface until the 1590s. It was sandwiched in this 1800-page book on the history of the Benedictines by Dom Arnold Weon in Venice, or at least it was printed in Venice. And nobody remembers that elbow-breaking book anymore, except for these few pages of medieval Latin and with some Italian mix that. Of these 111 mottos, two to three word mottos that are supposed to represent every pope till Judgment Day.
Oh, really?
And the final pope is a coda. It's not in a motto, but it's a short little paragraph that's rather doom-laden about a man called Petrus Romanus, Peter of Rome. So like the first bishop of Rome was a Peter, the last one's supposed to be Peter. Now, here's the thing that's interesting to me about it. When it came out, it was published in 1595. All the Pope mottos follow about 11 clues, which I detail in the book. It's kind of a little suspicious as a prophecy scholar when somebody is, you can find 100% hit on any of the 11 clues for the first 76 mottos. Now, it either makes him the greatest prophet in history or something else. Also, when there's some heraldry mistakes that are obviously taken from something that was printed in the 1570s, which was wrong about a couple of the herald devices. You see, that's one of the main things. One of the clues is you get all this, he usually mentions the name of the pope before he was a pope or his name as a pope. His heraldic coat of arms, either as his family coat of arms before becoming pope, or the coat of arms that he might use as a cardinal. It talks about the places that he ministered. It would talk about sometimes the chief nemesis that overshadowed his life. For instance, the motto for Pius the VII is Aquila Rapax. Which is a rapacious eagle.
Ooh.
And that's for the eagle standards of Napoleon, who had him arrested and imprisoned and basically in Versailles for a time. And it's the eagle standards of Hitler, of the other Hitler, Napoleon. Now to get back on track here, the if you've got so many things that are working so well, then this should fall right on its face as soon as it's published. It's just like all those wonderful decoding Nostradamus books that almost come out once a year, where somebody's figured out Nostradamus' secret and how you can unscramble his nebulous cryptic language. What I've come to understand is that Nostradamus had a chaotic mind. A severely retrograde dyslexic mind, and you have to get into that mindset and get into his space to kind of see the order in its chaos. And I can just say that there's no all-encompassing code that unlocks all of Nostradamus. And you know, there's been all these books that have come out that very strategically don't talk about stuff that can't go completely wrong until the book's been out for about a year.
Right.
So it's had its run.
Right.
I mean, if these people were really brave and courageous and believed what they were doing, they would set up a whole bunch of predictions and then seal it and document it and
right.
then release it
right.
in the book and say, these are the things that happened that we said were going to happen in the previous year. And look, And now this is what's going to happen next. And if we're onto something, they're going to happen at least 80%.
Yeah.
Well, here's this thing comes out on the popes, and what's remarkable about it, and I go into it in detail in that ebook, which you can buy on my website, and it's the succession has 35 more mottos and the coda. We have gone through all 35 mottos. The current pope. It's the 111th and final one that's mentioned as a motto. The next one is the last one.
Really?
And what you see is a remarkable accuracy. It's not 100%, but if you are a hard judge, it's in the 70 percentile.
Wow.
And if you are, and being a hard judge is, if there's something that's just a general thing that you could attribute to somebody, but then you just throw all those out. And you just deal with the ones that are mentioning names of people, dates, stuff like that. And it's still something close to the upper 70%.
Well,
and
that's quite a bit.
Some more tolerant people would say it's closer to 90% accurate. So,
wow.
So I'll give you an example. Pope John Paul II was called in the motto De Laboris Solis, which means from the sun's eclipse or labor.
Okay.
Now, a laboring sun in medieval poetry is an eclipsing sun. It's giving birth to itself.
Okay.
So he is the only pope in all 111 that was born on a solar eclipse.
Really?
And buried on April 8th, 2005, in the crypt underneath the Bernini altar in the Vatican on a solar eclipse.
Wow.
Now, which kind of gets back to the original part of your first question.
Huh.
Where do the popes play into this?
Yeah.
The pope that was the dean of cardinals who led the funerary proceedings, who was the man to decide when the pope would be buried, why didn't he choose a day before, a day or after? Why did he make it point to bury that pope on the day of an eclipse?
Huh.
Because they know about these prophecies.
They
officially,
must.
The Vatican is like, no, we never talk about it, but I can tell you, unofficially, it's talked about all the time.
I'll bet.
And then you have a pope who is called in the mottos De Gloria Olivae, from the glory of the olive, which is, his name is Benedict, a sub-sect of the Benedictine order is the Olivetans.
Huh.
Which are symboled by the olive branch, which is a symbol of Israel as well, which is also, now the question is this pope destined to be a peacemaker, or is he actually destined in his reign to launch what the Olivetans are responsible for in their ministry, and that is to prepare the world for what is coming in Jesus Christ's Mount of Olives sermon, which is the time where clearly, as best as we can understand, this is the time when Jesus is actually speaking from his own voice to witnesses who are recording it, rather than having somebody channel him like John did in the book of Revelation,
right?
Or Paul, who never met him in the flesh, and so on. So the thing that's fascinating about this is that this is Jesus talking about the apocalypse. This is where you will hear rumors of wars and earthquakes, and these will all be travails, I'm paraphrasing, to launch the New Age.
Right, right.
So my feeling is that the current pope is marked by these prophecies as the pope who will see the beginning of the tribulations that will lead to, whether it's self-induced or actually a propagated idea, the economics of creating a persuasion that you're going to have doomsday is called what I call Armageddonomics. That's like breeding to abandon, believing you can have you can exploit the earth till ad infinitum.
Right.
Know. These are all kind of habitual conditioned reflexes that make doomsday happen.
Yeah.
And so, but again, before the hour goes out and I must go, the thing that's important to remember is that just as Joaquin de Fiore saw it, that there may, on this side of the door of apocalypse, anyone who's interpreting it is interpreting it in the dark of this side of the door. When we actually pass through that door, the actual revelation may be quite different. Some elements we've gotten, but the essence of it may be quite different, quite more wonderful for everybody than has been doom-laden and projected or propagated.
How do you see that as coming through the other side of trials and lessons that we may finally as a collective consciousness choose to learn?
Yeah, we're being forced to grow up.
Yeah, yeah.
And human beings usually, when they have a collective danger,
yeah,
they do amazing things.
Yeah.
For instance, look what we did in World War II when we had the collective danger of Hitler and all that.
Yeah.
Look at what we did when we had a imminent danger for 40 years of nuclear attack from Soviet Union.
Yeah,
these were very creative acts, even though they were creative towards making war and stuff like that. But here we have something where the enemy is us, our stupidity.
Yeah.
And the enemy and the dogma that is against us is a fossilized dogma from the past that's now betraying us.
Yeah.
It once was great, but it's like, you know, I don't drive in a horse and buggy anymore, and a lot of the religions as we are educated in them are horse and buggy religions right now for
yeah.
the challenges that we're entering in a new era.
Yeah, they definitely haven't changed with the times, and especially with the ones that take a literal view of anything that's written, you know, because things are written in a certain period of time, and they're pertinent at that time,
yeah.
you know, and things change, so...
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of these rebel prophets talk about this, that there is always a refreshing. One of the more foremost among them is the Baha'i prophets. You know, they were very clear that the catalyst of world teaching has to be renewed. And the Buddhists understand this, too, that it has to be renewed. And even a few Christian mystics got away without being burned for it, like Joaquin de Fiori also said it way back in the Middle Ages. And there are a lot of other cultures, native, fourth world, others that parallel this feeling of renewal. So, you know, it's a birth, it's a death process, just like birth has death in it. Something is destroyed, so something is created. And the thing is that all of us, What's radical about it is that there's not really a person coming. If I were to interpret these signs and look with fresh, rogue, scholarly eyes, beyond propaganda and Armageddonomics,
okay,
that has been put in this brain of mine. See, I'm a big fan of brainwashing because I try to wash my brain with meditation every moment, because a dirty brain is not very nice. Full of all the garbage of borrowed stuff from other people.
Yes, I agree with you 1,000%.
Yeah, so I'm a pro-brainwashing kind of guy. I want to wash everybody's brains because they're filthy. Anyway, you have these prophecies about the coming of a new humanity. And people like Krishnamurti and Gurdjieff and Osho in the 20th century were at the forefront. Blavatsky, Aurobindo were all in the forefront of being prophets of this new man.
Oh, yeah. I myself went to a Gurdjieff-Ospensky school when I was in my 20s.
So you know well that yes. you know that there is a certain resistance happening in lower nature. Gurdjieff used to talk about that the nature is almost like this unconscious machine that is actually programmed not to allow anomalies that it doesn't understand to exist.
Yes.
It's a completely instinctive reaction to mutation. But the strange thing is that over time, as Gurdjieff also said, even planets must evolve or cease to be.
Yes.
He emphasized in his very harsh but compassionate ideas about the mechanicalness of humans that as it is now, he said,
right,
a key to that, you know, people don't actually have souls, they have to earn it.
Yeah.
Perhaps that is a device to what other people might say more softly is, you have a soul, but you might as well not have one because it's in its shell, it's in its seed, and it's never getting the proper soil of awareness and water of wisdom to flourish and flower.
Yes. Yeah.
And that most people that are incarnating come in with dry old seed souls.
Yes. Yes.
And that it does take work and effort to nourish and garden through consciousness the growth of your soul.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, there's a new humanity coming out of the crisis of the 21st century. It may take a few hundred to upwards to 700 years for this process to be finished. But in it, the new humanity, Homo Novus, as Osho used to call it, it is is a humanity that has found what I love this phrase from Osho. It's in balance. Its spiritual nature and its physical nature are in balance in what he used to call metaphorically Zorba the Buddha.
Huh.
He used to say in his wonderful soft way of talking, he says, "I love Zorba. He is so earthy. He is so passionate, but he has no soul. I love Buddha. He is so ethereal, so one with cosmos, but he has no body." You know, the future man has to be a balance. In fact, the greatest revolution that's coming in the future is harmony, balance. Not these extreme, excessive pendulum swings this way or that. And the creed of that new man is that they live in the eternity of the present. They've grown out of prophecy, and they've grown out of dogmatic religions. They live in the eternity of the present. And so if they're to be born, if they're in that future time living in the eternity of the present, the only way that they're going to be born is if you and I and all of you listening tonight live in the eternity of the present. That means one of the ways is that if one of the things that I've learned in my life on the path is that everything that's been taught to me is actually upside down from what it really is.
Yes.
There is no, if you love me, then I'll be happy. You know, or if somebody loves me, I'll be happy. There's no, here's the cause, and then I have the effect. I'm happy because somebody loves me. It's the opposite. I'm just going to be happy for no cause at all.
Right.
And then I'm free of the slavery of any cause.
Right.
And then the strange thing happens, in the law of existence, then the lovers, the friends come to you. Love comes chasing you.
Yes.
As the old Sufi statement says, you know, looking for love everywhere I go, looking for love in everyone I know. I tried to get it all together, but everything went wrong, and I let it all go, and then love came running after me. So that's what the prophecies indicate to me is how the human race of the future lives. And that human race can be born either 700 years from now, or it can be born right here, right now, with us, with each of us. And the Homo Novus, the new man, is not born in any collective way. He is born one individual at a time.
Huh.
And the key, as I understand it, is the science of self-observation, which is the core of all religious practice in the coming Aquarian Age.
Yeah.
It is a scientific perusal. It is true skepticism. That is not the cynicism that people call skepticism in our dirty word times.
Uh-huh.
Skepticos means to investigate. It has no prejudice for or against. So a person like a Buddha is an ultimate skeptic because he's simply watching without judgment for or against his mind and his emotions and the world surrounding him.
Right.
And so If that is engaged, and I'm a practitioner of meditation, if anybody wants to have me share the meditations I do and have learned over the years, you can come to hogeprophecy.com or just write to me at hogeprophecy.com, and I'll share with you what I know, and then you can experiment like your own experimenter to see if it works for you.
Wonderful. I'm running a little bit over, but that's okay. You mentioned the new human, and I was just wondering if that fell in line with some of the indigos and crystals and, the new kids that they're discovering.
The new kids on the cosmic block.
Yeah. They seem to be coming in a lot more spiritually developed than some of us older varieties.
You know, that it's an interesting thing. Now, I've had good friends like Laura Lee tell me that I'm now going to talk like an indigo. maybe it's my indigo talk here talking. But
right.
But beyond that, there are no indigos.
Okay.
There are no walk-ins. There are walk-outs.
Huh.
And Ruth Montgomery used to, that was the last fashion of this, was the walk-in. Somebody who had a spiritual crisis and then had a change, she theorized through her spirit guides that these were actually, the soul had switched and the old soul had left.
Yeah.
I think that's a misunderstanding of what's happening. Because actually, the problem is that when our false personalities, our egos, and our mechanical habitual machine is working, as Gurdjieff would say, in harmony of the three centers, the mind, the heart, and the kinesthetic, the body,
right?
When they are in harmony, the stuff, the thought forms, the habits and all that no longer influence us. It's as if somebody else had walked in, but actually it's these things have dropped away or gained some distance from us, and it appears that somebody's new is there. But it's like what Osho used to say, I loved it, when he said, people asked him once, how do you look at us? How do you view us, judge us? And he says, you are simply great, he said.
Huh.
Like, you are, it is hilarious too, because you are Buddhas pretending not to be. So
I wish I could have met him.
Yeah, I knew him. I was with him for many years.
Oh wow, you were lucky.
Yeah, and
I wish I'd known that earlier on. I would have asked you more questions about him because I've read.
Well, we'll do a show on Osho. That'd be fine.
Yes, exactly. That'd
I mean,
wonderful.
I was at the ranch.
Yeah.
I was one of his guards at his household and took him
my.
To the Burning Ghats, and that was an amazing story.
Oh yes, well you'll have to come back.
And yeah, I'd love to. I'd love to talk about him. Much more interesting than prophecy.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I had gone through the Gurdjieff school already, so that was kind of my little diversion. But then when Osho came around, I think I was busy doing drugs and drinking. I was having my own Buddha experience. So.
Well, I always loved how Gurdjieff loved a good drink.
Yeah.
The toast of the idiots. And his compassionate rehabilitation of this wonderful word, idiot, because we are all idiots.
Yes.
If you understand the way that means, or the root of idios is to be under the illusion of being separate from the logos.
Yeah.
And is one way of putting it, which means that you believe you're separate from the whole.
Yeah.
And that's where you get your identification is from the same root.
Yeah.
Idiosyncratic,
yeah.
The id.
Yeah.
And it's just basically the illusion of a misperception of like what Shankaracharya would say in 1000 AD is that, this world is real. It's your perception of it that's the illusion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That these many manifestations in the core are the Brahman, the one universal soul, the one core, the beingness. And, the dropping of the mechanical, the dirt in the mind, the borrowed identities. You know, we will always need identities. People in the future will have names and use language and be in dialectics as much as we are, but they'll have one perception we don't have. It's like these are tools of our mysterious passage through the mortal universe as we visit this planet.
Yeah.
And then when we disappear, those tools are no longer needed. It's just what we do here, it would be like, my car is my tool. But we deal with our identities like, I am my car.
Right, right.
And it's crazy, but that's why we suffer, because when our car gets a dent, we're hurt about it. But that's all going to change, and crisis will bring the change.
Well, we'll have to have you back again, because there's so much more to talk about.
Well, Lance, thanks for letting me blab along all that way.
Oh, it was wonderful. Thank you so much, John, for being on the show. And before we go, make sure that you tell people how they can reach you, where your website is and all of that.
Yeah, my website is hogueprophecy.com. That's spelled H-O-G-U-E. It's like hog with a U-E on it. You can email me at talktome. It's all one word, T-A-L-K-T-O-M-E. Or talk tome, since I write big books.
Oh, yeah.
At hogueprophecy.com. And there is a free bulletin that's posted there, and I send out notices every weekend about it. And right now we're in our six-part series called Between Iraq and a Hard Place.
Yes, it's wonderful too. I'm subscribed to that, and
it's quite
illuminating.
Yeah, and I've kind of left the print publishing world because I don't want to stay in the Cretaceous era anymore.
Yeah.
With the dinosaurs, and I've just gone into now I sell books in photons rather than paper and trees.
Well, that's smart.
And so, you know, I have, as with Internet, there's a lot of free things, but there's also some important books that take it the next step.
Yeah.
And right now I'm working on a book that will look at the hypothetical future possibility and prophecy of what a war with Iran would be like.
Oh, my.
And that's called Nostradamus, the War with Iran,
wow.
Which I'm feverishly trying to finish so that it will be out
before they actually do it.
Yes, which would be in late May, June, or into August. If it
happens.
Yeah, I'm writing feverishly. In fact, I was banging away on my keyboard right now when the phone rang and went, "Oh yes, I'm supposed to do an interview now." So, but it will be out and it'll be posted at with the other e-books. I also have created a new fictional genre called Scry-Fi, which will be introduced in the first short story called Kamikaze Tomorrowland.
Ooh, that sounds interesting.
And that's where we take a fictional metaphoric venture into where nonfiction future gazing meets fictional extrapolation.
Wow, and people might know or not know scrying. Is a means of looking, peering into the future usually through objects, isn't it?
Yeah, so the object will be your computer screen.
Wonderful. Well, I've often thought that it's like a Ouija board when I sit at my typewriter, you know.
Well, yeah, it is kind of like that.
It really is. I mean, especially when synchronicity starts to kick in and one thing leads you to another place, and before you know it, it's like, oh my God, I'm in the moment.
Then you're in the flow. That's the joy of it.
I love being in the flow.
Yeah, existence. I love how books tell me how they want to be written.
Yeah,
children, like pesky children says, no, Mommy, I want to be this way.
Oh yeah, I got one that's doing that with me now.
Yeah.
Not as talkative the last couple of days, though, so we have to open up the computer and see what it's going to tell me tonight.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that book on Iran will be out in by around mid to late May.
Great.
And if you sign up to the Hope Proxy Bulletin, you'll be the first to know.
Oh, good.
The people out there. And also, I have the book, The Last Pope Revisited, which is already there for purchase for a minimal fee. And the Tomorrowland thing should be out at the beginning of May.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
And hopefully by next year, there'll be a whole bookstore full of choices.
Well, great. Well, thanks again, John.
Well, thanks for having me, Lance.
And
wonderful inauguration of, I hope, many engagements.
Yes, absolutely. And next time we're going to spend some more time on Osho, because I would love to hear all about the commune and how he was. I just adored him.
Yeah, he was
an amazing man.
He was the best stand-up comedian since Jack Benny too.
Yeah.
He was a wonderful dry way of delivering a joke.
Oh golly, well we got to talk about that.
Yes.
Well, thanks again, John, and I guess we ran over tonight, everybody, in case you were wondering why the clock is ticking, but we were told that we could do that. So we did.
We misbehaved by permission.
Yes, we're rebels with a cause.
Yes.
All right, well, good night, everybody, and have a great weekend, and thanks again, John.
Yes, and good night, fellow rogue scholars.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yes.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.